this? Oh, you're recording. Good. Okay. Okay. I would say we start if it's okay with you. So today's noon conference about acute angioedema. You all have seen probably patients with acute angioedema, and angioedema is a condition that can really vary from very harmless swellings, very mild harmless swellings, to life-threatening swellings. So typically, you know, what we see in clinic, the majority of patients have rather harmless swellings, but they are scared about the swelling. So harmless swelling, what do I mean with it? It's not necessarily peripheral, you know, the extremities or so, but for example, lip swellings or periorbital swellings are typically very harmless swellings. And they, in particular, lip swellings is very common, and it's most common what I see is lip swelling without affecting actually the inner, you know, the pharynx or larynx. So having a pharyngeal or laryngeal edema is not that common, but it does happen. But most of the time, the, you know, angioedema is rather rather mild type. But you never know, so you have to be very, very cautious. Now, this is something more severe. If you have a patient who has a rather severe fascia to this extent, where you see, you know, you see the periorbital swelling and basically the whole face is swollen, those cases, you know, we take it a little bit more serious because they can, you know, progress into more severe angioedema or usually have additional symptoms, you know. This is usually a more systemic allergic reaction if you see something like that. That would be a picture of a swollen uvula and pharynx. So this is what you would see if you look into the mouth of somebody who has a pharyngeal edema. Obviously, we cannot see with our eyes, just by the mouth inspection, the laryngeal edema. But patients with laryngeal edema usually tell you they have trouble, you know, either breathing or swallowing. So those are warning signs. If the patient has either trouble swallowing or breathing, or has, a different voice, you know, the voice changes, then, you know, you definitely want to take it very serious and call the ENT to have a look. So this is the differential diagnosis of acute angioedema. I originally had in this lecture cases, but I took them out because I thought it was too confusing, and I thought we just try to really focus on the most common, most important differential diagnosis. So things that you can really hopefully carry away from today, so that next time you see a patient, you kind of like, you know, screen in your mind, you know, differential diagnosis, make sure you do the appropriate workup. So you all know that, you know, number one, you know, cause of angioedema or swellings, skin swellings, is allergy. So it's IgE-mediated usually. IgE-mediated means immediate type, so it happens usually, you know, immediately after being exposed to the allergic agent. However, there are some IgE-mediated allergies that can occur hours after the exposure. And we'll talk about that in detail. So each one, we're going to talk about it in detail. But just to give you a little overview, so IgE-mediated is really the most common. Then the histamine-releasing drugs. Now, that's something that you may see as in inpatients more common. So I try to make it the way that you may, you know, see pay, because you're doing inpatient care mostly. And so histamine-releasing drugs can cause angioedema, like opioids, radiocontrast media, vancomycin. Even vancomycin is mostly a histamine release that results in rash rather than angioedema. But so histamine releasing agents, obviously, through the action of histamine, can induce swelling. And just as an example, I don't know if you have seen any patients who had, we had a patient when I was a resident, who had a patient in Weiler Hospital with who got morphine for a, I think he had sickle cell anemia and had an attack, and a few hours later, or the morning after he had, you know, gotten his dose of morphine, he actually had quite significant, you know, perioral swelling and did have also trouble swallowing. So, you know, what is that? Well, it's, you know, many hours or a few hours after exposure to opioid. It's usually a pseudoallergic reaction. It's not an IgE-mediated mechanism. IgE-mediated mechanism is very rare in opioids. Then you can have, you know, swellings in response, like NSAIDs, aspirin, you know, ibuprofen, and so forth, or ACE inhibitors. You all know ACE inhibitor classical side effect is angioedema, but this has nothing to do with IgE or inflammation per se, allergic inflammation per se, and we'll talk about this also in detail. And then something that I want to mention here, because I think this is the most common type of angioedema that we see in outpatients. It is chronic urticaria with angioedema. So chronic urticaria is a condition that is very common, and typically in a large proportion of patients presents with angioedema as well. So just keep that in mind, because we often get inpatient consultations and, you know, they call us and the patient with angioedema, and when we see the patient and we take the history, I always ask about symptoms of chronic urticaria. You can't believe how often I pick up chronic urticaria. And then your whole differential kind of switches, you know, like the whole approach to the patient switches. So it's very, very important to remember that chronic urticaria is common, and it commonly is associated with angioedema. So if a patient presents to you, let's say you're the ER resident, you're admitting a patient with angioedema, please always ask, obviously, is this the first time you have this swelling, and do you have this, you know, itchy rashes, you know, do you suffer from itchy rashes, and you will be surprised how often you pick it up. And then these down here are really rare conditions, okay, relatively rare conditions, and I will not talk much in detail except for the hereditary angioedema. But so there is something called idiopathic or exercise-induced anaphylaxis, which is very interesting. We'll talk a little bit about it later. C1-esterase inhibitor deficiency, you all know about that. And then these rare conditions, Gleick syndrome and angioedema and hypersynophilic syndrome. I will not go into those. Okay, these are very rare conditions, but for completeness, I want to have them here. Now, first let's talk about the IgE-mediated allergic reactions. And as you know, you can be allergic to anything, right? And the most common ones, obviously, are food, drugs, and venoms. And I already mentioned their immediate type. They're mediated by binding of allergen-specific IgE to the allergen, which leads to histamine release from mast cells. Severe reaction or anaphylaxis almost always occurs within 30 minutes after exposure. And if you have a patient who has anaphylaxis or you think of anaphylaxis, remember that most cases with anaphylaxis also have skin symptoms. So nearly 100% of patients have skin symptoms. This is very, very, very helpful, because you will run into cases where, you know, with shock or dropping blood pressure, and you're not sure, you know, what is going on here, particularly if it happens during procedures. And there's about 20% of patients who have anaphylaxis can have a late phase reaction that can happen up to 24 hours after the event. Now, how do mast cells release histamine? So just as a reminder, basically from immunology, so you have IgE, which is this yellow here, it's an Ig antibody, and patients who have allergies, and maybe you have allergies, or you have seasonal allergies, spring season, or cat allergy, or whatever, so what you have, let's say you have a cat allergy, or in order to make it an allergic, let's say you have a shrimp allergy, then you have an IgE antibody that recognizes the epitope of shrimp protein. And now the IgE has one specificity that is different from all other antibodies. Its receptor, the Fc epsilon receptor, 1, is a high affinity receptor. And that means that the IgE kind of sticks onto its receptor, which is mostly on mast cells, all the time. So it's kind of the high, it has very, very high affinity. Other antibodies in the body, if you think of IgG, IgM, IgA, they don't have that. They don't have such high affinity receptors. They just bind and get loose again and so forth. It's a certain balance in all these receptors. But the IgE is so far different, as it has a very high affinity to its receptor. So why do I tell you that? It's because that means that these mast cells that are sitting mostly under our skin and in the mucosa and respiratory mucosa, as well as GI mucosa, they are coated with IgE all the time. So they are, you know, exposed to this high affinity receptor, are coated by IgE. And now, as soon as the antigen comes along, the mast cell is being activated and degranulates. And that's why you have this fast reaction. That's why allergies happen fast. It's because of this. And this is what happens. So it then degranulates and, upon binding of the antigen. This is the same picture in electron microscopic view, which I like because you see here really a mast cell, how it's packed with these granules full of histamine and heparin, by the way. And after activation and degranulation, it looks like fuzzy, but it's actually, now it's actually more activated even. So it's degranulated, but now it actually starts producing additional inflammatory mediators, which is very important to remember because that's why you have eventually a late phase reaction. So it's not all, you know, once and it's gone and that was the reaction. So presentation of anaphylaxis. I want to go into this a little bit, and I hope maybe I brought it. You can see. I wanted to show you how to use an EpiPen. I think I don't have one. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, basically, presentation of anaphylaxis. So I said before, in most cases you have you see skin symptoms, and I'll tell you one case that we saw as a consult also in Weill Hospital, who's transferred from Jacoby to Weill to get a cardiac cath, and that was a lady who had CHS. So see, her breathing wasn't great to start off, and particularly when she lied down on the cath table, so the whole thing was a little bit unstable to start off with. But then, so they started the procedure, and at the moment when they haven't put any actually they haven't even inserted the catheter. They just had done some local anesthesia. They had given her fentanyl, and they were about to insert the cath, and then all of a sudden her blood pressure dropped. Okay. And then you know they interrupted the procedure, and she was short of breath, her blood pressure dropped, so they interrupted the procedure, and somebody called us because they weren't sure could that have been some type of allergic reaction, but no one had any idea what that could have been, you know, because she didn't even get contrast yet, you know. So when I talked to the cardiologist over there, he told me that he did see a very short-lasting rash on her chest. And that was probably the reason why they called us, you know. But so that was a very, very helpful hint. But still, the whole story, you know, she got dyspnea, she had blood pressure. I mean, it's cardiac, right? You would think a patient, you know, cardiac cath and so forth. But so what we did at that point, we actually sent out a serum level for tryptase. Have you ever heard about tryptase levels? So tryptase is also something that the mast cell produces. So the mast cell I mentioned before produces histamine, heparin, so on, but also tryptase. And why is that very useful? Because the tryptase has a much longer half-life than histamine, for example. When you release, and the mast cell releases histamine in the body, the histamine is being broken down like within a minute or 2 minutes. You know, so it's very short-lived. That's why you can't really measure it in the serum at the right time. But the tryptase lives much longer, and it usually peaks about, you know, 30 to 90 minutes after an anaphylactic reaction. So we send out a blood sample that was drawn around that time when she, you know, worsened. But it takes about a week until you get it back. And we also send out a latex RAS because there was a question of latex use and so forth. And to all our surprise, the tryptase level came back very, very high. And the latex was also positive. So she probably had a, you know, allergic reaction to latex. You know, it was really surprising. And the, you know, she had a real anaphylaxis. Okay, so very helpful to see any type of skin symptoms. Now, remember, skin symptoms doesn't mean necessarily only a rash. It means also you can have angioedema or just itching. But those are very important signs. Itching is very helpful. You know that usually histamine is involved. Respiratory symptoms are very common. As a matter of fact, I think, you know, anaphylaxis, obviously, there are different definitions out there of anaphylaxis, but the most preferred definition is any systemic allergic reaction that affects either circulation or respiration. And I think that's a fair definition because I don't like to call anaphylaxis somebody who just breaks out and hives. You know, it's not severe enough, but you do see, unfortunately, some publications that use it that way. But respiratory symptoms are common, and then obviously, you know, circulation and abdominal symptoms also common. So whenever you see somebody or you have somebody on the floor and the nurse calls you, let's say you start somebody on ceftriaxone IV, and then the nurse calls you, says, you know, I think the patient has some type of reaction, can you come? And you go to see the patient. If the patient is there and has hives, you know, like here and there, and says, I'm itching terribly, you already, you know, the nurse already stopped the infusion, itching everywhere, and then you kind of start thinking, right, should I, okay, let me give Benadryl, right, itching or tachycardia, give Benadryl. And then the patient, let's say, 2 minutes later says, I get really nauseous and starts vomiting. This is not a good sign, okay? If you have a patient who starts with GI symptoms, you know, that means usually it's quite severe. So in those cases, or obviously if they get a dyspneic or they start, you know, feeling dizzy or something like that, you would take it very seriously. What would you give them? What would you tell the nurse immediately? Yeah, exactly. So this is the first thing you do. Actually, you can, even when the nurse calls you on the phone, she says, I think this patient has an allergic reaction. Before you even go there to see the patient, no matter how severe the reactions are not, why don't you just tell the nurse on the phone, get me ready and a vial of epinephrine, you know, with a syringe for IM injection or, you know, even if you give the subcutaneous, okay, but... So just remember, epinephrine, okay, you want to have epinephrine ready. Now at this point, I want to quickly, I want to just quickly go over the treatment of anaphylaxis with you, because it's so important. And so I already mentioned, if you have an inpatient or you're in the emergency room and you have somebody with anaphylaxis, first line treatment is epinephrine, right? So that you just remember. Now, what is the dose of epinephrine? What do you tell the nurse to draw up, you know?
0.3?
Yeah, uh-huh, correct. So 0.3, what, do you remember? Milligram, correct, okay. So 0.3 milligram. Okay, and then the nurse says, well, milligram, you know, she just gives you a vial in your hand, you know, and it's a 1cc vial, usually. The most commonly used is the 1-2000, it's called epinephrine 1-2000. What does it mean, 1-2000? It means just it's 1 milligram and 1 ml. It's actually quite convenient, because if you want to give 0.3 milligram, you give 0.3 ml, right? So it's easy. So you can, if the nurse comes to you and brings you that vial of epinephrine, you just say, you know, 0.3 ml or 0.3 milligram. Okay, you need 0.3 milligram. What needle do you want? How do you want to give it? Patient has an IV access, but you know your epinephrine IV, you know, that concentrator, you know, don't want to do that. So how do you give the epinephrine?
IM.
Yeah, so the best way is IM. Now let's say the patient is really obese, okay, and the nurse comes with a little really short needle. What do you do then? Huh? Yeah, exactly. So I would do the same. I would not, you know, wait until the nurse gets you a longer needle, so you just give it subcutaneously. Okay? So sub-Q or IM, both works, definitely works. IM works faster, and you get faster a plasma peak of epinephrine. That's the reason why we usually prefer IM. But sub-Q does work. We had, you know, patients who were treated with anaphylaxis with sub-Q, and believe me, it really works fast as well. Within minutes, you know, you have an effect. So no matter which needle the nurse brings you, just get it into the patient. Now, where do you want to inject it? Where is the preferred, you know, location where you want to inject it? It's actually the thigh. But, however, that is only because studies have been done, really, on the thigh. So, and the studies with the EpiPen, you know, have been done on the thigh. If you have an inpatient, there's really no reason not to give it on the deltoid, for example, really. I mean, even though studies haven't been done that look for the peak, you know, plasma concentration, but, I mean, you know, obviously it will work as well. So, you know, my take on it is, like, give it wherever is convenient. You know, just because the most important is don't delay it. Okay, the one big mistake in anaphylaxis is to delay treatment. You can't, even if you, by mistake, you give 0.5 of epinephrine, or you give only 0.2, or, you know, whatever. Don't worry, the patient will be fine, but don't delay treatment, okay? That is, the epinephrine is really the lifesaver.
Is there not less fatty tissue in the deltoid?
Yeah, I mean, if you have an obese patient, you may be better off, you know, trying the deltoid, you know, but, and subcutaneous, it probably doesn't matter where you do it. I always do it also on the arm, you know, if I give subcutaneous injection of epinephrine, because it's convenient and it's not as traumatic for the patient, you know what I mean? Like, in particular, if you have an outpatient. But now, real quickly, an EpiPen. I just wanted to show you how it looks. Unfortunately, this is the older model. They came out. They just came out with a newer model. It looks very, very similar to this one. But I think it's worthwhile that everybody, if you has once in their medical career, seen an EpiPen. So this is an EpiPen. What is an EpiPen? EpiPen is an auto injector of epinephrine. The dose for adults in here is 0.3 milligram, the same dose that you would give to your inpatient. There is an EpiPen Junior for children, and there's half the dose, but it's not always correct because children is really a weight adjuster, but we have only one dose for children. But so for adults it's 0.3 milligram, and this is how the EpiPen looks. So let's say you're really, allergy is getting more and more common. It's not unrealistic to think that one day you're somewhere outside in the park, you're a day off, you go to Glen Island, you have a barbecue there. And then, family next to you, somebody says, oh, allergic reaction, somebody ate a shrimp, and somebody, and it's, all upside down, and you feel like, well, I have to help, you're a doctor, you have to help. So now you go there, and the mother said, you ask what's going on, let's say it's a child even. Okay, because children are more common in this outpatient that you see that. But let's say it's a 12-year-old child. Children are really small adults in terms of allergies, so you can feel confident even treating a child. But let's say it's a 12-year-old boy, and the boy really has trouble breathing, is red, eyes are swollen, doesn't do well. You see, this is allergy, And then the mom says, I have an EpiPen, but I don't know, how to use it. And then they think, oh, you're a doctor, okay, and they give you this, okay. So now it's good for you to know how to use it, right? You have seen at least one. So the newer model would be orange in the tip and has a blue back. So otherwise it's really the same thing, okay. So it's really the very same thing. And what happens, you don't see a needle. The needle is hidden inside. And all you have to do is, you want to give it IM usually, and I have to stand up to show you. So it has an arrow, shows you where's the front. Again, the new one is intuitively, you will see that the orange is the front. There must be the needle hidden in there. And what you have to do, you just have to have it in your hand like this. You don't have to press or push or pull anything. Just hold it in your hand. You take off the back. It blocks it, basically, for protection. And then you inject on the thigh, the anterolateral thigh. Somewhere where the meaty part is, basically, okay? And how you do it, push onto the skin, you push until you hear a click. Now you have to count them to 10, okay? So it's about, to me, about 5 seconds to inject, but on the safe side, you count up to 10, and then you take it out. Okay, so this is how you give it. So just remember, and it's easy to inject. Okay, you put it on the skin. It goes through the clothes also. So if there's too much clothes, or the boy, is ashamed, doesn't want to take off the pants, so just give it through the jeans. Okay, you just do this, press, and then count up to 10, and pull it out. Now the new one, the older one, you would still then see the needle. Okay, this is just a fake one, a trainer, but the newer one is constructed in a way that this plastic part pulls over the needle when you pull it out. So just keep that in mind, that you will not see the needle, neither before nor after, okay? And just, that some patients, they think now the needle is in the leg or something, so you just have to tell them that nothing bad happened. And, okay, and then of course you would still call 911, okay? Even though you would be surprised, the boy may be better, he may be back on bias line within 10 minutes, okay? But you still need to call or, recommend to go to the emergency room if he improves because of a possible late reaction. This only holds for about 15, 20 minutes. So that's why, the recommendation is to seek medical help.
If you have say someone carries their own EpiPen,
yes,
in a pharmacy or something,
yeah.
How old the child would you give it to? Would you give it to a sort of infant or would you give it to a...
The adult size, you mean?
Yes.
Okay, the dose of epinephrine is 0.01 milligram per kilogram. So a 3-year-old child is usually, 15 kilograms, where it's ideal. If a child is about, once they're about 30 kilograms, so it's like maybe a 8-year-old child or a 10-year-old, it really depends also on the body weight, then you should be fine using the adult one.
But if you have the adult one, would you give it to a child?
Really tough. I mean, yes, I would. I would. And I may just not count to 10, you know, I may just inject it and kind of pull out a little earlier. I mean, it's a tough one, you know. But, you know, if it's a life-threatening situation, you can't do anything, you just have to do something. Okay, now causes for anaphylaxis. So food is still the leading cause. In inpatients, however, is drugs is the leading cause. So you, what you see here, if you see anaphylaxis in the hospital, then you will see this, of course. Insect bites and stings, not that uncommon, 5%. Latex is rare, allergen vaccines, rare, exercise induced, rare, and idiopathic, about 30%. So this is very interesting. So you have patients who get anaphylaxis, no one knows why. I think that probably this is from, you know, ER data mostly. If these patients, once they are worked up, you know, then this number is lower, you know. Okay, so workup of IgE-mediated reactions, we can do skin testing. The problem is when you now, as with your inpatients, you know, you have a patient who has, for example, you know, a patient here now in the ICU who was supposed to get amphotericin, who has a, you know, history of allergy to amphotericin B, and they called us. And the problem is we can't really do a skin test. I mean, we could, but it's not very useful because it's not standardized. We don't know really what, you know, if it's positive, well, okay, you know, maybe supporting the diagnosis, but what if it's negative, doesn't say anything, particularly because most drug allergies are to metabolize of the drugs and not the native drug. And that's why the drug testing with the native drug is often useless. Penicillin is the only one where we now have back one of the metabolites which we can test. It's called PrePen. It's being produced again, but we don't have it at Jacobi. You know, you may be picking up about 80% of penicillin, truly penicillin allergic patients with this test, but you may miss about 20% because they may be allergic to another determinant or another metabolite, basically, of penicillin. So it's a little bit a tricky story. I always think desensitization is fast, it's safe, you know. So I always tend to say, well, why not desensitizing? You know, well, you know, particularly already here as an inpatient. Food goes best with fresh food, particularly if it's fruit or vegetables. The food testing is pretty good. I mean, those things is probably not, you know, so relevant for you in adult medicine. It's more like in pediatric medicine. But just to let you know, so food testing is pretty good. The negative predictive value is thought to be more than 90%. And the positive predictive value depends on the size and on the clinical history. There is a refractory period, though, and we know that from venom anaphylaxis. So what does that mean? If you have a patient who, let's say, was admitted to the ER after a bee sting, had anaphylaxis, and you would like to find out which venom was it, was a wasp, a bee, a yellow jacket, or so, and you call us, well, you know, probably not very helpful because we'll tell you, well, we can't do skin testing anyway at the moment because we have to wait at least 4 weeks because for some reason there is this refractory period that the skin test is suppressed after anaphylaxis. You can do serum IgE testing, though. That is not affected by this refractory period. In vitro testing, I want to just quickly mention that when you order allergy testing in our system, you still type in the RAST, R-A-S-T, for radioallergy sorbent test, which is really an outdated method, and we don't use it anymore. Jacobi, the laboratory upstairs, does not use that test, but it's just like traditionally still, you know, as a term in the computer, the test is not done with radioactivity anymore. It's a much updated system that uses a chemiluminescent signal instead. And we're using here in Jacobi the Immulite system, which is a very good system. The other very good system is ImmunoCAP at the moment that's being used. And while limited sensitivity and specificity is similar to the skin test, basically. Just one thing you have to keep in mind, if you send out allergy tests, and, you know, I don't know if you ever will send them out, but if not you, then I'm sure you have, either you have children yourself or you have friends with children or relatives with children who, you know, got some allergy test at some point. Many pediatricians, for example, send it out if there's some suspicion of food allergies. And it's just very good to know that they have a limited sensitivity and specificity. So if the food test comes back positive, it does not necessarily mean that this reflects a clinical food allergy, and vice versa. If the food test is negative, it doesn't reflect it. And this is demonstrated even better. This is from a clinical study where they actually had, in this case, were children, egg allergic children, who had this test, basically what we still call RAS test, but it basically measures the specific IgE in serum, and then were challenged with egg to see if they really were allergic to it or not. And what they found is the following: they found that the cutoff, when we talk about a negative, is usually 0.35. Now, in our Emulite system upstairs, our cutoff is even 0.1, so it's a very sensitive method. But you see, it doesn't make too much of a difference in terms of predicting a reaction. But what's important is when we have a negative, so this would be a negative, serum test for egg allergy, for example. The serum test is negative, so it will say the less than 0.35, negative, okay? The chance of still having a clinical reaction if you feed egg to this child or even an adult one is still about 25%. Okay, so this is how the situation is. Very important to remember. And similarly, if you go the other way around, let's say you have an egg IgE of 3.5, the probability of having a reaction is only 75%, so there may be still 25% chance of not having an allergy to egg. Okay, so that's why, that's where the allergist comes into the picture, because up to this point you could just handle it right by yourself, not a big deal. But so what the allergist would do then at this point, if you send the child then to us or the adult one to us, we actually do food challenge. We do additional testing to really figure out, and then we can do food challenge. I mean, anybody can do, but it's just risky. You have to have the things, around to treat anaphylaxis and so forth. Okay, treatment of anaphylaxis, we talked about epinephrine. I will not repeat this, but just quick reminder, dose is 0.3 milligram. Just keep this in mind for adults, 0.3 milligram, okay? Very important point is positioning, okay? Very, very important. Let's say you have a patient in clinic who has anaphylaxis. Okay, let's say he's a patient who got just his allergy shots in our clinic, but he already gone to lunch, and then the patient comes back and the clerk gets you and says, this patient, allergic reaction, and then you sit the patient, or the clerk already, sits the patient on the chair, here's the patient, swollen a little bit in the face, red face, trouble breathing, and so here you are, okay, so what do you do with the patient? Okay, and of course, what you tell the nurse? Epinephrine, right? You immediately, 0.3 epinephrine. Can you pull up epinephrine for me? Okay, this is number one, okay? Then, if the patient, particularly if the patient looks really sick, and particularly if the patient has some type of dizziness or something, you want to lie the patient down, okay? No matter where, you have to lie them down. Why? Because in anaphylaxis, you can have a great amount of fluid shift into the extracellular tissues, up to 50% within 10 minutes. I mean, that is just enormous. And deaths from anaphylaxis, the most common, pathophysiologic mechanism of death in anaphylaxis is empty heart syndrome. So just remember that, okay? So lying the patient down is often difficult because they're short of breath, so you can't often do it, but at least put the legs up, try to, position them somehow. it can be very... I had a patient who, that was really a nightmare, who had an allergy shot in our clinic, but the problem is that the extract was mixed by another doctor who mixes that usually differently in a different clinic. So it was a problematic situation, and the patient had an anaphylaxis, but not in our clinic. The patient was already on her way out. So they called me from somehow, luckily they got our number upstairs, and they said there's a patient here in the main lobby of building A with probably allergic reaction. So I just took your epinephrine quickly and I went downstairs. And the patient was very sick. I mean, it was a 70-year-old lady. She, I gave her the epinephrine right away, but we put her on the floor. I told the security officers to hold her head. It was really bad. But you know, we gave her epinephrine right away, and then she didn't really improve after the first dose. And there was a bad situation because no one knew which team comes. I wanted to call a code or something, but I needed help. So I sent somebody to pediatrics, and we gave it, you know, a second dose of epinephrine. They gave me another epinephrine, and then eventually we recovered fully. Within like 3 hours, she was back on baseline. And 2 weeks later, she came back for her next allergy shot, which was really surprising. But so in any case, so if you have the situation, just remember lying the patient flat on the floor or whatever you have, you know, just do that. Then oxygen supplementation. Of course, you want to have oxygen as soon as possible. Yes, you can give albuterol nebulizer if there's bronchospasm and so forth, but just oxygenate the patient. It's just basically the ABCs, okay, of your you know, ACLS. IV access, okay, that may be, you know, only for very severe cases. You know, you don't worry about that in the very initial setting. You just want to get epinephrine, positioning, oxygen. Those are the most important. And then, of course, if the patient's on a beta blocker, the epinephrine may not work. Okay, that's the problem. That's why you have to give glucagon. It's also on your little ACLS card, you know, in case you run into this problem. Antihistamines are, yes, I mean, always good to give also antihistamines, but they work very slowly. That's why it's not the first-line treatment in anaphylaxis, okay? It's always good, yes, you want to give Benadryl, you know, 25 to 50 milligram, or even 100 milligram, you know, in acute anaphylaxis, but whatever you have available. And then steroids, but again, really more to prevent a late-phase reaction, not for the acute treatment. The slides will be also posted somewhere, right? So you, if you want to, you know, look at this later, then you can go back.
Question. Uh-huh. The use of the pepsin, I mean,
okay.
I was always wondering, H2 blockers,
yeah.
Are they really relevant? Can it make a difference?
Okay, so this is, it's a very good question. H2 receptors are in the endothelium under the skin. We know that, but very few only. And it's actually not so clear why H2 blockers would work at all. But studies have been done quite some years ago where they infused histamine into people. Okay, so basically they induced anaphylaxis via infusing histamine, okay? And what they did, I mean, it's quite dramatic, okay, they did it. And then they checked the blood pressure and saw how much the blood pressure would drop. And they found that if they gave an H1 antagonist only, the blood pressure would still drop. But if they gave H1 and H2 together, they could prevent the drop of blood pressure. And that's the rationale for giving H2 blockers. Otherwise, there's really, you know, I mean, not good. For example, in chronic urticaria, if a patient with a lot of itching and so forth, some people give H2 blocker. I find that don't work at all. I mean, I don't give it. You know, it's really more like in anaphylaxis that we still want to prevent it. If we desensitize a patient, we usually give H1 and H2.
If a person needs prophylaxis, how would I do the H1 and H2? If the patient is in hospital, for example, and he has IgA deficiency and he needs to get blood.
Yeah,
he has previous reactions. I need to give him blood, but he has this. So I would give him free blood, a pre-transfusion, Benadryl.
Usually what we do, I mean, you know.
IV and also how do I do the PFC? Then?
You can give both PO. You don't even have to give it IV. If it's for prophylaxis. But blood transfusion, of course, is a little different because you don't usually have IgE-mediated, you know, immediate type reactions. So the histamine doesn't play such a big role there to start off.
Okay.
I mean, you may still give it because it's harmless to do it, but blood transfusion is a little bit different. But if you do it, for example, for desensitization, you know, then we give usually Benadryl 25. We don't want to knock out the patient, you know, just for
blood. And the PFC 20 is enough, 20 milligrams.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
the steroid dose, what would be 1 milligram per kilo? The steroid, for example?
Yeah, I mean, usually I give like between 0.5 and 1 milligram,
mm-hmm.
You know. And that also really depends on the
system. Does the glucagon work?
I don't know. I do not know how the glucagon works. Why the glucagon reverses the. It actually just increases sensitivity to the action of epinephrine. But I do not know the mechanism.
Isn't it effect? Is because of the beta agonist effect, the glucagon?
No, I'm not sure. But it has to do with the expression of the you know, better
to
yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. 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 It sensitizes you to the action of beta agonists, you know, but it is not a beta agonist. Luca was not a beta agonist.
It does not
but it's just sensitive. By itself. You need to give epinephrine.
Exactly. Exactly. You're not just giving glucagon and then things are fine. You give epinephrine and glucagon, you know what I mean? Yeah. Okay. Then, so histamine release in drugs, I mentioned that. Immediate or delayed onset of symptoms. So it's basically the same mechanism. So in terms of treatment, you don't really care if it's IgG-mediated or if it is this person that got morphine and then 4 hours later has swelling of his face or so. Okay, you don't really care because the treatment is the same. It's histamine, you know, mediated swelling, you know, and you just treat it the same. So, you know, when in that moment when you see your patient, you don't really think about the theory behind, you know, you do. So you have, you know, opioids, radiocontrast media, let's say you are the, how do you say, the MAR, you know, the admitting resident, it's 2 a.m. and they have a CAT scan downstairs in the ER and boom, and there's a, you know, reaction to the radiocontrast media, they call you, and okay, so you know, it's histamine release, you know, it's a pseudoallergen, you know, it's just directly releases histamine, okay, you know now what to do. The mechanisms are often not well understood. I said there exists exams already, and there is actually something very interesting.
With IV contrast, the IV dye that we're using over here in the hospital, down
yes.
there in mm-hmm. the hospital, what the percentage of patients that can get allergic reaction if they have seafood allergy? I was thinking with you, it doesn't say that much.
No. This is. I'm glad that you're bringing it up because that's an old myth.
No. I have a seafood allergy, and that's iodine. I say, whoa.
Yes. Yes. And you know, it's. I'm really glad you bring it up. So, the answer is, seafood has nothing to do with radiocontrast media. Okay, shrimp, shellfish, whatever has nothing to do with radiocontrast media. You know, the problem is that these old studies that were done about shellfish allergy. Shellfish allergy is one of the most common food allergies in adults, right? So what they found is that people who have this type of food allergies, which just happens to be the most common one, somehow is, you know, more frequent, people who have this food allergy more frequently seem to have problems with radiocontrast media. But the reality now is that it has nothing to do with the shellfish. The reality is that an atopic patient who has either food allergy or environmental allergy, so like a cat allergy, also poses a higher risk of having radiocontrast media allergy. So any atopic patient is at risk, you can say. But again, and believe me, it's not only patients, it's some radiologists even, that still think that shellfish allergy is a real big thing, but they don't realize that we have patients who have a dust mite or cat allergy that's so much more relevant than, you know, because they are highly, highly allergic, and that this is actually as an equal risk, you know, than having a shellfish or whatever.
And this patient that wants to sue the hospital, she has seafood allergies, but
yeah.
They gave her contrast.
Yeah.
And I was like, hasn't nothing to do with it.
She had a reaction, or?
She was complaining of itching.
No.
But that is a
big, you can measure
itching.
So if I was a radiologist, I think what would make sense, you know, in terms of assessing the risk for it would make sense to ask them if you have any food allergies, if you have any respiratory allergies like an allergic asthma or something like that, to get an idea how atopic is the patient. And those who are highly atopic, my experiences in clinic, they do have more common reactions. So you may not convince, you know, the patient or so, but just for your own knowledge, you know, and how to assess the situation, and you may even want to pre-medicate in some situations, but you just may want to get an idea how atopic is this patient. You just ask, do you start having, you know, sneezing and itchy eye in spring season? Do you have any allergies that you know about, environment or food or any medication allergies? Just keep in mind that an atopic patient is at a little higher risk of having a reaction. But the new radiocontrast media are really safe, so it's rare to have, you know, to see reactions anymore.
And the histamine release was more of the iodine.
Correct. So the iodine, yes. But it has nothing to do with iodine to start off with, you know. The iodine is a red herring. It has nothing to do with iodine. You know, you can't be allergic to iodine. It's an element, right? So, there are some people also who think if they are, you know, like the same as the sulfate, for example. I'm sure you have patients who have bacterium allergy or something, and then they say, I'm allergic to sulfur. They tell you. Now, first of all, sulfur is an element. You can't be allergic to sulfur, right? So sulfur is in everything, in other drugs, in food, everywhere. So it's not true that they're allergic to sulfur. So in those cases, you need to always pinpoint what do you mean with it? Do you have a reaction to an antibiotic? And then it turns out, yes, I had a reaction. It was usually Bactrim or something, you know. But Lasix is a sulfate, you know, drug, for example, you know. So so you have to know, you know, how relevant it is. Okay, one interesting thing is that there are also some food that can act as pseudoallergens, but that happens usually in patients who have a predisposition of having allergic reactions, such as chronic urticaria patients or patients with mastocytosis. Mastocytosis is, you know, an increased number of mast cell load in your body, basically. And those patients can have reactions to certain food. They eat food that are usually harmless to us, for example, spicy food or ketchup or so, you know, like usually we don't get any problems here. As a matter of fact, alcohol is also pseudoallergy, and I had a chief resident a couple of years ago. He came to us and he said he was at the party and he drank a beer, and next day he was like full of hives and he didn't know, is he allergic to beer, you know? And you're not allergic to beer, no problem, and it's probably, you know, it wasn't clear why this happened in him, but it's just that, you know, some factors go together, maybe stress or so, and then with one of these pseudoallergens you can actually develop a real histamine, you know, related rashes or reactions. Those rashes are usually harmless. They don't go into any life-threatening reactions, but they're annoying, you know, and it's very good to know which food can do that. But I won't go into the details. You're going to have the slides, so if you ever have a reaction to that, or you go to a party and next day you have hives, you go back to the slideshow and you can look through the list and see if you ate something of it. Okay, maybe 5 more minutes. Now, there are adverse reactions to certain medication, NSAIDs and ACE inhibitors, right? And it can also cause angioedema. Now, the most common problem that you will encounter is aspirin allergy because of your cardiac patients. And some of them will tell you, well, I can't take aspirin because I'm aspirin allergic. And in particular, if they have asthma, you have a real problem because they can have a real asthma attack after aspirin. And what's the mechanism of it? It's not IgE mediated. So it's a non-IgE mediated, it's a leukotriene mediated mechanism, and it can happen to any NSAID, not only to aspirin. It can even happen to Tylenol, by the way, so because usually we consider Tylenol as safe. But if you take a high enough dose of Tylenol, it would also happen. And then just, you know, I know you know about aspirin allergy, I don't want to bother too much about it, but the issue of Tylenol here is, yes, you can give your patients Tylenol for pain control, like 300, 500 milligrams, but if you give 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol, the patient with aspirin allergy has a 30% chance of having a reaction, okay? So a 30%. 30% reaction. I had one patient who had aspirin sensitive asthma and who had a very bad reaction after she took a, you know, 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol for headache.
But it should not be the same mechanism though, because I mean, I don't think paracetamol.
It does. It does. It's a COX inhibitor as well. Mm-hmm. It's just weaker. That's why you need more of it, you know, that's all. And how it works, basically, just a quick reminder of the mechanism. So you have a cell stimulation, which happens all the time in the cell, if you have pain, inflammation, or something like that. And basically, you have release of arachidonic acid from the cell membrane. And now, as you know, this is a substrate of many, many enzymes, and among others is the light oxygenase and the cyclooxygenase 1. And the NSAID is a blocker of this enzyme. And what happens is usually, without blocking this, one particular prostaglandin, the PGE2, inhibits, you know, under normal circumstances, the production of leukotriene. So it kind of keeps it in balance, okay? Now what happens is, if you block this one, then this cannot block this anymore, mm-hmm. right? Because it's not being produced, so what happens? You get more leukotrienes and angioedema. Okay, now, away from the NSAIDs, ACE inhibitors. Okay, real quickly to remember, why does an ACE inhibitor lead to angioedema, right?
I mean, ACE... Excuse me, in the other slide. So I avoid the paracetamol because it would block the COX-1, is that?
No, the paracetamol or the acetaminophen are usually safe because they are very weak cyclooxygenase 1 inhibitors. But what I said is that in high doses, you can also trigger the reaction. Okay, in high doses. But we give it to them, to this patient all the time. All the time. I mean, you know. ACE inhibitors. So just why does an ACE inhibitor induce angioedema, right? You know all ACE, you know the role of angiotensin 1 or angiotensin 2 and so forth. But that's not the matter here because that wouldn't really make sense, right? But the reason why ACE induces angioedema is because other than... converting, you know, playing a role in the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, it actually also leads to the breakdown of bradykinin. So that's one of the functions of ACE. Okay. So if you don't have that, you get more bradykinin, and bradykinin, you know, can do, leads to NO production in endothelial cell, which eventually leads to angioedema. Okay. Now you will see, so this whole bradykinin pathway, just keep this a little bit in mind for now. So you have here kallikrein, kininogen, bradykinin, just keep it in mind. This is very important when it comes to swellings. And because of the next one we'll discuss, so chronic urticaria and idiopathic, I will not talk about those now. They are very rare. Just for you to let you know that this exists, there is something called exercise-induced anaphylaxis, which is people who have food allergies, and is most commonly associated with wheat allergy, who can eat wheat without any problem, like eat pizza, wheat bread, you know, spaghetti, you know, without problems. But if they eat it and then they do exercise, they get anaphylaxis.
Then they're obese.
No, not necessarily.
No.
Okay, the time is almost over. I don't know, do you want to still touch on the C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency? It's up to you guys. If you, yeah? Okay. Yeah. Maybe those who have something to do, you know, you're welcome to leave.
Why exercise induces anaphylaxis? Why that? Because
it's not clear.
Some asthma related to exercise.
Yeah, asthma is related to exercise, but that's different.
Okay.
It's not known why, you know, what the exact mechanisms are, you know. Okay, so C1 inhibitor deficiency is rare. Okay, so even though this is probably the first thing that pops in your mind when you see a patient with swelling, this is actually the one of the rare reasons. Okay, so C1 inhibitor deficiency is most commonly hereditary. It can be acquired, but it's rare as well. Hereditary is autosomal dominant, inherited. It is about 1 to 30,000, 1 to 50,000. That's how common it is. And in about 25 to 30%, it can be caused by a new mutation instead of inheritance. And it really depends on the genetic defect, which type of hereditary angioedema you have. And the way you think about it is this. Either you have a genetic defect, and the genetic defects can be a whole variety in the C1 inhibitor gene, about like more than 100 different gene defects discovered. So it's not a straightforward one gene disease, okay, or one mutation disease. There's many mutations. But depending on the defect, you can have either enough C1 inhibitor production, but the protein doesn't work well, or you can have not sufficient production so the whole protein is basically not translated, or one of the genes is disturbed, the other works, but you have, because the one copy is not working, you have only insufficient production, okay? Now, if you have insufficient production because of a non-functional gene that cannot be transcribed, basically, you're going to have type 1 angioedema. Okay, so most common one. Type 2 is the one that you can still produce enough protein but doesn't work properly, and that's about 15%. Acquired angioedema acquired C1 inhibitor deficiency is happening in patients with tumors sometimes, particularly certain lymphoma. They can either produce certain enzymes that break down C1 inhibitor or inhibitor. Again, it's rare, but occasionally we pick up those patients. Okay, now this is a complicated slide, but I just wanted to demonstrate, because this will give you an understanding where these new treatments are coming from, okay, for hereditary angioedema. So the C1 inhibitor, the name that it carries, C1, is from the complement cascade, okay, which is here in the middle. So you have the complement cascade, you remember it's part of the innate immune system, you need the complement system, you fight off infections basically. And the complement cascade starts with certain complement factors, and the function of the C1 inhibitor usually is to kind of hold that down, because our complement system, while we are sitting here, is activated all the time. So we don't want to have an overwhelming complement, you know, activation that would die from inflammation, basically. So the C1 inhibitor kind of holds it down all the time. And so this is why it's called C1 inhibitor. But what's important is that the same protein has also function in other pathways, and those are the coagulation cascade. It actually inhibits the transformation of some coagulation factors, and in the contact cascade. And remember I told you, just think of the kallikrein bradykinin thing. Here we are, okay? Same thing again. We are here by the kallikrein. Basic C1 inhibitor actually inhibits the kallikrein, and therefore inhibits the contact cascade. And why is that important? Because remember with the ACMR we talked about bradykinin. It's basically the system where the C1 inhibitor plays a role, and it usually kind of like holds it in check, okay, the bradykinin system. So therefore, and this slide really shows everything, I don't want to bother you with too much detail, but now you can really logically think which treatments are there and where, you know, which treatment would you use. Now you, in inpatient care, you probably are most worried about an acute attack of a C1 inhibitor deficiency, right? You get a patient, or a patient has to go to surgery and they call you, has a C1 inhibitor deficiency, they want to know, you know, what should they give, you know, for prophylaxis. So either acute attack or prophylaxis, those are your greatest concern. And there are different medications. One, the most straightforward, is a C1 inhibitor concentrate. Great, okay? You're deficient of this, you just infuse the concentrate, you're fine. However, unfortunately, it's not FDA approved yet for the acute attack, but it has been approved for prophylaxis at the moment. And
but the hospital doesn't have it.
Oh, sure, not formulary, you know, yeah. But if you have, I mean, if it's really necessary to get it, I mean, you can...
have to bring it from another hospital.
Exactly.
So it's not clear if it's going to be here on time, but yeah, we don't know.
It's difficult. It's difficult to get for acute attack. If you want to use it for acute attack, it's not approved for acute attack anyway, but... so this is the easiest. Then we have medication like androgens, for example, like attenuated androgens like danazol or stanazol, for example. They induce production of C1. I have it in the next slide, but I don't want to leave this slide now. But they produce it. They induce a production of the C1 inhibitor in the liver. Okay, so you get a little higher level. And then there are medications that the antifibrinolytic agents that are being used mostly for prophylaxis, but also in acute attacks. And what they do is kind of interesting. The reason why they use, because they inhibit the plasminogen activation, and consequently you have kind of a sparing of C1 inhibitor, because the plasminogen is all the time activated in our body. So if you dampen that down, then you have a little bit more C1 inhibitor available. So those are the classic ones, and luckily there's a C1 inhibitor concentrate now available in the United States. But then there are more fancy ones. This is the kallikrein inhibitor. It's a kallantide, and that has been just approved last year by the FDA for acute attacks. Actually, this one you can use for the acute attacks. It's kallikrein inhibitor. And then icatibant, that's a bradykinin receptor antagonist, but it hasn't been approved yet. Okay, but those, the reason why I mentioned them, because they were just in the 2 weeks ago or so in the New England Journal of Medicine, there were all these articles about those medications. You may have come across some of those. Okay, and just for you to remember, how do you diagnose hereditary angioedema? It's now very logical, because I told you that the type 1 hereditary angioedema are those people who can't produce enough, right? So if you send out a C1 inhibitor level, and luckily our laboratory is smart in terms of that, when you type in C1 inhibitor, it automatically gives you the functional, so you always want to know the functional. So it should be low. right? You can't produce enough, so then you don't have enough function either, so it's low, right? In the type 2, you have a sufficient level of it, but it, the function is low, right? So the C1 inhibitor function will be low as well. Some other hospitals use still both tests, an antigenic level where you have the absolute amount of protein and the functional level. But really, if you want to catch two, you better off just send the functional one, right? You catch them two instead of missing one. By the way, I didn't mention to you, but I want you to be updated. There is now a hereditary angioedema type 3, okay, that has been recently described. It's very, very poorly understood. It happens exclusively in women. It seems to be estrogen dependent. Happens, you know, depend on the menstrual cycle, and all the levels are actually normal. You have a normal C1 inhibitor functional level. Okay, so it's not really understood what is the exact defect here, but it has been described. Okay, so now C4. This is the only thing that you come across with your patients. C4 levels are typically low. However, and you see that in review articles over and over again, C4 isn't good enough for screening. And I agree with it if it's during the attack. If it's outside the attack, the literature is not very good. If you look at the original references where all these, you know, the statements are based on, there is not much data in between attacks. So, and we do know they can normalize sometimes, so we know that from the literature. So I would be cautious saying that, you know, it's 100% good screening test. You know, if I really have a strong suspicion, and the patient does not have right now angioedema, I send out the C1 inhibitor as well. I don't rely on the C4 alone. That's my last slide. So,
which kind of drugs can trigger, I would say, the acquired ACE inhibitors? Aspirin as well? No aspirin?
No, aspirin usually not, unless you have a patient who is aspirin sensitive.
Okay, so ACE inhibitor, because in the other slide you showed that some drugs can trigger the acquired one, is ACE inhibitors?
Not only the acquired, any.
Any
angioedema can be triggered. So in these patients who have already the low C1 inhibitor, they just need a little trigger to tip you over, basically.
Oh,
so it can be infection, it can be, you know, trauma, stress, emotional stress, you know, all these things can kind of tip them over and get into that.
So then they have the C1 inhibitor deficiency, and then when I give them ACE inhibitor,
that's
they
a problem.
Have the crack.
You know why? Because they are more susceptible to getting attacked. You can increase the frequency of attacks because
of... Is it ACE inhibitors or another drug, as I'm asking? Any other drug that it should be kind of just...
No, not to my knowledge. It's really just ACE inhibitors.
And aspirin, only if they have susceptibility, okay.
Yeah. So that's the reason, ACE inhibitors, because ACE inhibitors basically, you know, have the same issue with the, you know, they interfere with the bradycardia.
Contrast, no.
No, the bradycardia is a histamine release.
Yeah,
it's a different, totally different mechanism. But generally, you want to be always cautious with these patients because, you know, like they already get these swellings very easily, so anything can tip them over.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your patience.
There was someone in the surgical service that developed laryngeal edema and angioedema face and tongue, and he said that he had family history, but it was very strange and wouldn't add up.